its face.
I'll be back.
They know its mission. But there's one thing they don't know. This time, there are two. Terminator 2.
Hasta la vista, baby.
Arnold Schwarzenegger. Terminator 2. Judgment Day. Rated R. Starts Wednesday, July 3rd at a theater near you.
Welcome to Podcast Action Hero, the show that listened while the Terminator laid it all down. Skynet, Judgment Day, the history of things to come. It's not every day you find out your podcast is responsible for 3 billion deaths. We took it pretty well.
I think I'm going to throw up.
Get to the chopper!
I want to ask you a bunch of questions.
Hey, Christmas tree!
And I want to have them answered immediately.
I'm not a pervert!
You son of a bitch!
I think Brits are very sensitive.
Get your ass to Mars.
I'm not shitting on you. Fuck you, asshole.
Hi, I'm Gavin.
And Jamie.
And this is the podcast where we basically talk about Arnold Schwarzenegger films for an hour. And in this episode, we are talking about 1991's Terminator 2 Judgment Day. Jamie.
Hello.
What is your history with this film?
I don't actually know when I first saw this. I remember the kind of like the zeitgeist around it. Because I was like 12, I think, when it came out. And I remember being in the car park at school, looking at trading cards that had come out before it, like the bubblegum cards and stuff, and just seeing all, basically, spoilers. Parts of the last scene were all on these cards, so I knew exactly what happened. But I don't remember the first time I actually saw it, which might be my first instance of an Arnold film that I've never not remembered seeing, even though I was 12, you know. But I've seen it quite a lot. I don't know, maybe less than 10 times, though. But then, obviously, I saw it with you when it got re-released in 3D a few years ago. I know for a fact you've seen it more than me.
maybe a couple of times. There are some episodes we've done where I've watched the film for the first time. Not many of them, but there's been a few where I've watched it for the first time. But then other than that, it feels like every other episode has been, I do not remember a time where I had not seen this film.
Yeah.
But with Terminator 2 Judgment Day, I do remember a time when I had not seen this film.
Interesting.
I remember this coming out of the cinema, and I remember the build-up and everything that was around it. And I remember one of my childhood friends who lived across the road from me when I was a kid, his family had like satellite TV when it seemed like hardly anybody had it, but he had it. This would have been like, I guess, 2 or 3 years maybe after the film came out, but I remember him getting very excited that it was about to come on Sky Movies, that Terminator 2 Judgment Day was going to be on there.
That would have been around the time Sky Movies started, right?
Early 90s, yeah, so it's got to be. And like you, I remember, yep, the bubblegum cards or the stickers and getting the albums. And what was weird is this was clearly a film that, despite it being R-rated, was in many ways merchandised and marketed to kids.
100%. Part of a grand tradition, really. There was like, because I remember primary school, all the kids had seen Robocop and Aliens, and some people had seen like Nightmare on Elm Street, but I guess by that point that was being marketed to kids a little bit as well.
Well, yeah, for definite. The Robocop thing in particular, I've got a vivid memory of being in primary school, first year of primary school, so what, 5 years old? Mm-hmm. 4 or 5 years old? And there was this lad who clearly had been, whether it was with an older brother or with his dad, been watching films that he, at 5 years old, definitely. Like, I think all of us watched Robocop for the most part before we should have done. But this kid was 5 years old and he was reenacting the Alex Murphy execution scene where he'd be on his knees like going, like shaking his body and everything, and then like miming the bit where his arm gets blown off and then sticking his arm behind his back. And this is 5 years old.
We always used to do the thing where everyone who got shot in Robocop, because of wearing a suit, their tie always flew up in the air. So we always used to get our school ties and just like wave them around in the air. Anyway, not Robocop.
But what I suppose what I'm getting at is like there were so many of these films that clearly we would have watched much younger than perhaps we were supposed to have done. But yeah, Terminator 2. I don't remember the first time I saw it, but I do remember having not seen it. And I remember the excitement of it coming up. I mean, it's entirely possible that I might not have actually seen the first Terminator, although I might have done, because I'd have been 7, 8 when Terminator 2 came out. But I had the toys. I had the battle-damaged Terminator where his chest flies off, and I had the car randomly. He had a car that fired a rocket. I don't know.
Of course. Do you have a Mega Drive game?
Do you know what? I had the Terminator 2 Mega Drive game, yeah, because I had the Sega Menacer light gun as part of it as well. But yeah, anyway, that's my long rambling history with this film.
I feel like we can be long and rambling on this one. It's probably, I don't know about in terms of cultural impact, probably, but also in terms of sort of like box office, I think this is the most successful and the biggest of all of Arnold's films, right?
It took a long time for it to get knocked off. And was it Cameron himself who knocked it off with Titanic as well? Or did something else knock it off before that in terms of box office? And
it might have been Titanic, yeah. I actually did a little bit of a deep dive into box office and all that kind of stuff. Suffice to say that adjusted for inflation, if it had come out now, it would have cost $230 million and it would have made $462 million, which is still less than Top Gun Maverick made, but more than anything else made that year.
That's really interesting. I wonder why that is. Less people are going to the cinemas now. Yeah. Is it the cinema? Is it the ticket prices for the most part? Is it?
Well, it's ticket prices, but also Top Gun Maverick was an anomaly, to be fair. It made less overall than Avatar 2, but Avatar 2 made $684, but on a budget of $460. So Jim Cameron can still get the high numbers like he always has. It's just his budgets are too high now, so he's not making as much. And also, T2 was in the cinema for 70 weeks.
That's more than a year.
No, sorry, not 70 weeks. I knew I'd read that bit wrong. 26 weeks,
right?
Which you don't see much now. So it had time to make that money.
Yeah, absolutely. These days it'd be after 4 weeks, it'll be on Prime or Netflix or...
Yeah.
So, Jamie, I think we're all missing one thing at this point.
The synopsis?
Yeah!
Everyone knows. Okay, synopsis, Terminator 2. We think it's set in maybe 1995, right? I don't think it's ever confirmed on screen.
Yeah, they never say the actual date, but
we
get the idea that...
it's close to Judgment Day, which is 97, right?
Yeah, and we get the idea that that John Connor's, I guess, around about maybe sort of like 12 years old.
He's meant to be 10, according to the behind the scenes. And there's no way that kid's 10.
He's 19 if he's a day.
Well, the kid was actually 14, I think. Playing 10, I think that's a little bit of a stretch. But anyway, so John Connor, son of Sarah Connor and the resistance leader of the future, is living with foster parents.
They're kind of dicks, huh?
They are kind of dicks, huh? And a Terminator is sent back in time again for another attempt at killing him rather than killing Sarah. But another Terminator is sent back to protect him. In the meantime, Sarah Connor is locked up in an asylum for her own protection, apparently, because, frankly, describing the plot of Terminator would put you in there. And then it plays out like a big-budget version of the first. The new Terminator, the bad guy, tries to hunt them down. The original model of Terminator has been sent back by John in the future to protect John and Sarah. Well, actually, just John. Sarah's a byproduct. Young John wants to rescue her. They also stop the future war from happening by destroying all of the stuff that's crucial to the research of Miles Bennett Dyson, who creates Skynet, and the Terminators both die. It's kind of beat for beat the original one.
Absolutely. I've long contended that, and it's why I've often said that despite that I think this film is more rewatchable than Terminator, the first one, I still prefer the first one for a couple of reasons. One, it's more of a horror. Sci-fi, which I'm a big horror guy. I can't help it. Yeah. It's always going to be the case. But also, like, you've got to recognise that the Terminator is much more. Well, I was going to say it's much more original. I think there's like a sci-fi author who might contend some of that fact.
Yes,
but generally it's the same. Where it's original, whereas Terminator 2, like I say, it's beat for beat. You can almost like overlay them on top of each other, and it's like again, you've got the two time travelers arriving in the same sort of way. You've got them going through the process of getting their clothes. You've got them going through the process of tracking down their targets. You've got them going through even some of his actual homages in this one, like where Schwarzenegger's T-800 and the T-1000 are fighting, and Schwarzenegger gets thrown through the window of the shot, and it's an absolute throwback to when he gets shot through the window in the nightclub.
Yeah,
in the same way. So,
and there's callbacks like the fact that the T-800 says, "Come with me if you want to live."
Exactly.
George Lucas would approve. It's like poetry; it rhymes.
But even all the way through to, again, you've got chase, you've got truck chase, you've got truck crashes, it explodes, the explosion damages the Terminator but doesn't kill the Terminator.
Kind of ends in like a factory/foundry kind of thing.
Exactly. So it's just kind of like, he just picked out his old index cards from when he planned Terminator 1 and said, yeah, we'll just follow the same thing. Now, whether there's something sort of poetic in history repeating itself or something in there, I don't know. Or he just knew it was a winning formula. But it is almost beat for beat, same as the first film.
It's almost like a special edition kind of thing, where James Cameron's just gone, okay, we can do it properly now.
Well, I heard, I don't remember where I heard this or when I heard it, but James Cameron wanted to have a liquid metal Terminator in the first Terminator.
Okay.
But the technology was clearly not there at the time. There was barely enough technology to do like an animatronic Arnold at the time as well, wasn't there? So
also in 1991, as it turns out. That scene where he's getting shot in the building does not look good now.
This is it, right. So I've heard people referring back to Terminator 2 and saying the effects are still amazing. And by the way, the effects, they are amazing. However, The people who say that Terminator 2 still stands up compared to like current stuff, he's like, I'm sorry it doesn't. Like, I love this film. I love it. I think the effects are great. I think a lot of people, myself included, but maybe others more so, have got so much nostalgia tied up in this film to say that the effects are amazing. It is great, but you can literally see the seams in some parts of it.
It's to be expected. It's not a criticism. It's just saying it hasn't aged particularly well effects-wise, partially because the rest of it looks so good.
Mm.
The stuff that isn't effects, you know, like his staging, his blocking, his the lighting, the kind of blue sheen he puts on everything, it all looks really classy and high budget and whatnot. And he's got a very good eye. And that's why when it cuts to something where you kind of go, well, yeah, it's 32 years old. Of course it doesn't look like it was made yesterday.
I think the effects held up for longer than might have been expected for a sci-fi film for an effects film. But I think you can still look at it in the context of when it was made, how it was made. In the same way you can go back and look at like Jason of the Argonauts, or like, you know, the Ray Harryhausen effects, and you can look at them and go, Definitely when I watched them as a kid, I was like, this is rubbish. But I think you can look back at them now with an eye of, do you know what? Thinking about the time when this came out, and the effort that went into it, especially, it's nothing short of amazing. But
you can appreciate it on a level where you don't necessarily have to kid yourself into saying it still looks great. You can just kind of say it looked great at the time, and I can see why.
That said, Jamie, is it possible that we are on the return of a pendulum swing? Because a lot of the discourse around special effects lately is talking about how, especially a lot of the Marvel films, they're putting such a tight, such a lot of pressure and tight timescales on effects studios. The quality of the effects that are coming out now are not great.
No, they look pretty terrible these days.
So I wonder if we've gone past the apex point of special effects where they're amazing, and now it's swinging back to a point where they're just not going to be that great. And actually, again, Terminator 2 will start to look, by comparison, better than modern films.
They'll be holding it up against like Ant-Man 3 and stuff.
You already can.
The problem with the modern ones, of course, is that every shot's got CG in it, and like some shots have got no actual real stuff in them at all. It's kind of apples and oranges, really, but at the same time, it does kind of highlight this was revolutionary at the time.
Mm.
And it was still like a showstopper, you know, like, oh my God, there's like CG morphing. There's a liquid metal person. It was noticeable. But it was a thing to be celebrated, and now it's just so commonplace. It's become boring, and maybe it does, when you look back on this stuff, feel more exciting because there was something interesting about it.
I think you're absolutely right, and it's over the last 20 years, the spectacle of special effects seems like it's gone away now. I mean, you had The Abyss a couple of years before this, where clearly Cameron's testing out some of those liquid morphing effects with the water.
He's admitted as much, yeah.
Just on, you know, a much smaller scale. And then this film comes out. You can just imagine at the time, like, you can do this? What? How? What's going on? Like, is this what computers can do? And then we had at least a decade, if not more, of absolute shit special effects where everybody's trying to do it without necessarily the budgets. And then you had The Matrix, which, again, if you go back and watch The Matrix now, especially the sequels, Christ, they've not aged well. I mean, I'd maybe contend the sequels never looked great at the time. But some of the stuff in the Matrix was just like, I can't believe that they can do this and the amazing things that they're doing and so on. And maybe it's just got to the point now where we're starting to become fatigued with it all. And it's like, well, we know we can do it.
Right.
Everything, you know, the universe can be created. We're seeing what fucking Unreal Engine 5 can do on games consoles. And how amazing that looks.
Yeah.
So now, when we see a special effects shot that doesn't look anything less than pristine, we immediately get that uncanny valley feeling and like, ah, this is shit. Even though 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we might have looked at it and gone, that's amazing.
And when fidelity gets to that point, it's time to start going, well, what sets us apart then is the other stuff, you know, the artistry to it, rather than can we do this and make it look real? Maybe put some art direction, you know.
In a lot of episodes, we've talked about our various note-taking, and typically I usually write about half a page of notes. That's half an A5 sheet of notes. I don't tend to write an awful lot. For this one, I wrote an absolutely groundbreaking 2.5 pages of A5 notebook, which is unbelievable for me. That's more than I've written for the past 3 episodes at least.
And it's weird because you've contended before that you stop writing when action starts, and the action never really stops in this film.
It didn't, and that's something to definitely talk about. Is like, I think one thing you can say about this film is it's long, and we watched the special edition version of this one where it had the, you know, the additional scenes of the head surgery, and I got this VHS and widescreen. I did not own a widescreen TV. I don't think I realised it was in widescreen when I bought it. So it was like super small on my bedroom TV, on the portable TV in my bedroom when I watched it. But it was still great. But back then it was called the T-1000 edition. And instead of the usual Arnold on a motorcycle poster art, it was just liquid metal, chrome ripples covering up the entire cover on there.
Yeah, that's kind of boring.
It was a little bit, but I was super excited about it because, again, especially when I was a kid and I was becoming a bit of a film nerd, anything that was like bonus features, I was like, what? Yeah. And so I do remember I don't remember the first time I watched this film. I do remember the first time seeing the head surgery scene where they aim to reset the switch in the chip.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing that for the first time because I was about 15. And I just remember being blown away, even at 15, just thinking, this is just the best film ever.
That scene, I actually think, is a good addition. There's a version of that scene, right?
Mm-hmm.
Picking bullets out of him, and then it cuts to the next
one. It comes to the bit where John Connor's asking him, how do you learn to stop being such a dork and all that? And it's where he says, my CPU is a neural net processor, a learning computer, but Skynet presets the switch to read only when we're sat out alone. Instead of that, it says a learning computer. And then there's this, like, when you know it, it's fucking awful. But it's this really bad ADR piece of dialogue where it sounds different than the rest of it. You know, like the room tone drops out. And it's like,
you and he were buddies, weren't you? Sorry, I just think of Garth Marenghi.
But it's like just this random line all of a sudden where you don't even see Arnold speaking because it was put in there afterwards. And it just focuses on John Connor and Sarah Connor. And Arnold says, the more I'm around humans, the more I learn.
That's fine.
And it shaves almost 10 minutes off the runtime of the film, which I think is why they did it.
Yeah. But the version of this where there's an action to be taken by the main characters, and it's like their choice to make him more human. It changes the dynamics. It makes more sense. It's more interesting, I think. It's just maybe a longer scene than it needed to be.
By taking this scene out, you remove that amazing piece of drama between John and Sarah, where Sarah, immediately getting the chip out of its brain, wants to destroy it.
Yeah.
Because she's like, this might be our only opportunity to kill this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then John's like, no, it's, you know, this thing's here to protect me. It's heartbreaking. He calls it his friend. No, he's my friend, all right. And then the point where he sort of really asserts himself and says, you know, if I'm supposed to be a great military leader, maybe I should, you start listening to me once in a while. It is. It's just a great scene. It's a visual spectacle and it's a fucking amazingly acted. Them two together are great.
Considering this was his first film as well. What do you think to John Connor's character in this?
Good question. He is equal amounts entertaining and annoying.
Yeah.
I sort of seesaw massively between wanting him to live and wanting him to die.
Okay.
So I'll take the hit. I'll happily be one of the 3 billion people whose lives are extinguished on Judgment Day at various points in this film. I'm like, just do it. Just poke him.
Fair. I don't know how much of this is Edward Furlong's performance and how much of it is just the way it's written, but he doesn't get you on side.
No.
It takes a while before he does anything that's decent and not just him being... I mean, that's his character. He's, you know, he's a troublemaker kind of kid. But he's meant to be 10, and immediately he's just the worst. Of all the things he does, I mean, I've got no problem with him stealing a bike and using a stolen credit card and going to the arcades and playing Afterburner. We all do that, you know?
Well.
We've all stolen a bike. But the worst part for me about him is when he's first talking to the Terminator, and the Terminator grabs him, and he starts screaming for help, and these two guys come over, And then by the time they get there and ask if he's okay, he's just a complete dick to them. It's a really weirdly written scene because he then makes the Terminator beat them up. Well, that's what he thinks is going to happen. What actually happens is he nearly shoots one of them in the head.
Yeah, I think what's happening here is he's been set up at the beginning where he's basically a juvenile delinquent, right? He's a product of the foster system. He's had a really interesting childhood in terms of he's, you know, by the time he's 10, he's learnt weapons. He's learnt how to hack ATMs and all these kind of things.
Yeah.
And I can imagine he's had one of these childhoods where he's like a 10-year-old adult almost.
Yeah.
You find out later on he explains what his childhood was like a little bit. So I can imagine that what you see in the combination here is the attitude, the armor that he's had to develop to survive the childhood that he's had so far is what you're seeing in that scene in the car park where you've got the two jock douchebags and all that stuff. But that is him completely not appreciating the weapon that he now has access to. He's a kid with a gun. Even though he knows what a Terminator is, it doesn't occur to him for a second that as soon as like these two guys pose any kind of threat, well, the Terminator's going to do what the Terminator does.
Yeah, of course. I'm a Terminator.
Exactly. So it could be the performance, it could be the writing is a little bit heavy-handed, but I think the scene is necessary to set him up as overly confident in who he is and completely... He's at the absolute pinnacle of the first stage of the Dunning-Kruger effect, where he's got unconscious incompetence. He has no idea what's going on and is somehow fully confident in his ability to deal with it until that moment when he realises that, oh shit, I don't know what I'm dealing with here.
Yeah, and then basically as soon as him and Sarah and the Terminator all like get together as this group, he suddenly becomes the responsible one, which is odd because she's then got to be the one who's going off and trying to, as we said, destroy the chip or, you know, sabotage the mission or go off. She goes off half-cocked and leaves them in the desert to try and kill Dyson. And he's suddenly the voice of reason and the conscience. And I guess they're trying to imply that he's helping the Terminator become more human and the Terminator's helping him become more responsible, I guess, by just giving him these straight facts and being the father figure that he never had.
Yeah, essentially. And I think with John Connor, the idea is that he's the saviour of humanity who, throughout all this, is maintaining and indeed strengthening his own humanity to the point where he's also giving it back to Sarah. Sarah's very much, we meet her at a point towards the beginning of this film where her humanity has been stripped away.
Yeah.
And that really culminates when she goes to assassinate Dyson because, you know, she, and it's not exactly subtle, but she wears all black. She wears black shades. She becomes the Terminator, right? She's going to go and kill this guy.
Yeah.
And then at the last second, she can't really follow through with it. And then it's that when John comes to get her and she's like, you came to stop me.
Yeah.
It's like his humanity at that point is what brings her sort of back from the edge.
That's probably one of the parts that's new and completely unique to this version of, you know, of the story. It's not a beat from Terminator, which I quite like.
Anyway, there's a couple of things that I wanted to talk about from the beginning of the film and one in particular that we mentioned when we were watching it. So I just want to say that the opening for this film, the cold open where you've got the kids sort of playing on the park and then it goes slow motion and there's a bright flash and then it immediately cuts to the burnt out wasteland. And that's where you get sort of Sarah's voiceover where she's like 3 billion human lives ended in August 29th, 1997, Yeah. And then it sort of pauses on that skull. I'm not sure, is it a child's skull? Or I'm not sure, whatever it is.
I'm not Mr. Skull Measurer.
And then you're not Leonardo DiCaprio in Django Unchained then.
Oh, God.
So you've got the skull in the wasteland, and then the T-800's foot comes down. What I like about this scene is that in the first film, we had to wait until the very end to get the full look at the full metal skeleton. Because, you know, you get glimpses of it when he's taking the battle damage and so on, but it's not until the very end when he's burnt and that's when you see the skeleton. In this one, it's like, let's just get it out of the way.
Yeah.
Here's loads of them.
Why not? Everyone's seen it by now in all the posters and the bubblegum cards.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's something James Cameron wanted to do more of in the first one, but perhaps didn't have the budget for, was more of that future war and more of what's going on there. And that's what you really get. And you see a bit more of the reality of that one to kind of set, again, to remind people this is what we're trying to avoid.
Do you know what? I didn't, over the years, I've not really, and still now, if I picture them both, I don't see an awful lot of difference between how it all looks, the future version of the world in Terminator and Terminator 2. I'm sure there's a world difference, but like in my head, they both look exactly the same.
I get that. Yeah, side by side, I think you would notice the difference. There's a lot more stop motion involved in the original, and no skeletons either. It's just the HKs. It's the tanks and the aerial HKs.
We did talk about on the very first episode that whole scene was really good for 1984.
Absolutely.
In fact, that whole future scene in T2 is one of the parts that probably does hold up the best because it's like a controlled environment. There's no reality to compare it to, so you can just go wild. You can tell like there's rear projection and stuff, but I quite like rear projection. Apart from in driving scenes, I feel like it looks pretty good.
So in that particular scene, apparently, there is actually no rear projection. There is rear projection, but not in that scene. It's like rear projection that was done beforehand and then filmed and then played again in the background somehow.
Yes, it's like three layers or something, isn't
it? Yeah, absolutely. The second thing I want to talk about was just the opening credits as well. This is something that you don't get on films anymore.
What, opening credits?
Yeah, let's stop the film. Let's have an opening credit scene, which in this one, it's spectacular, like a work of art. It's the playground is on fire. They've got a flamethrower going through it. And then Brad Fiedel's score through it is just brilliant, which is like an amazingly updated, like some more of an orchestral version of the first film, which was very
synth.
Yeah, very 1980s synth music, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it
really was.
And then just the skull coming out of the fire, and like what my note at that point was like, this is just so fucking cool.
It's a very specific kind of early 90s cool. But as you say, it's not just the special effects that this inspired. This inspired a whole look for like a decade. The title sequence alone, not necessarily the bit with the playground. You didn't have every 90s movie starting with a playground on fire.
Should have done.
Three men and a little lady. But there was that kind of blue brush steel metal things clanging together. I remember Speed had the same kind of intro, and I feel like The Fugitive to some degree.
And then the Matrix changed it in the 1999 where everything was green after that.
Everything was green, yeah. The thing is, right, any influential big-budget sci-fi film sets a template, and because Hollywood's so unimaginative, they just go, oh, that made some money. Let's just make loads of things that look exactly like that for the next decade. Or create something just as iconic. You know, it doesn't have to be just one thing. As much as this was a roaring success as a film, I feel like it had a legacy that's probably equal parts good and bad. Because it inspired a lot of good stuff, but it probably inspired more bad stuff, come to think of it.
I suppose just in terms of like the idea that in order for a film to be successful, it now has to have, like every film needs to be the most expensive film ever made. And every film needs to have special effects in it now. And, you know, to your point, you know, the lack of imagination, I think, with a lot of studios is they're going to be watching this film thinking, it's so successful, people are absolutely loving it. We need to make a film that looks like that.
Yeah.
But literally, like, what about the skeleton of it? What's going on underneath the surface? It's like, what do you mean? Let's just make it blue and make it cost millions of dollars. That'll be fine.
Yeah. The reason this film works isn't because it's surface level. It might appear to be surface level, and it's certainly not like the deepest thing in the world. But it was made with a lot of passion, a lot of love, and you can tell that James Cameron, you know, it mattered to him, and he had ideas from way back that he couldn't do in the first one he's implementing here. There's themes about found family, there's whole things about fate and destiny and all that kind of stuff, and I feel like that's the stuff that doesn't get noticed when people are looking at what to make next.
Yeah. Really briefly, and then I'll stop talking about the opening 5 minutes of the film. There was something that you pointed out in the scene where the T-800 arrives, something that you pointed out, and I said, I know how they did it, and I wonder, did you see how they did it on any of the stuff that you've watched since then?
I didn't know.
So remind us what the bit was.
It's the imprint left of the electric ball that Arnold arrives in. So you've got like a crater in the ground, and then you've got parts of, is it a truck? Parts of a truck that have just been like burnt away and don't exist anymore. And it's like the edges of the metal are kind of made to look like the red hot.
Yeah.
But it looked like neon paint.
Right. And then, you know,
and then it faded, so it wouldn't have been.
Right. Did you notice when it started fading?
Was it to do with an angle?
Yeah, it's when the camera started moving.
Ah.
So I could tell you the way they did it, based on what I saw a while ago. It's the same way they did the lightsabers in the original Star Wars films. It's reflective tape, or like a reflective paint.
Oh, that's kind of boring.
Yeah, it's just the way it's set up. It's reflecting a particular colour light directly back at the camera, And that's it. So, but then when they move the camera, it's no longer reflecting back on there. So that's just the way I did it. It's a super cheap...
It's a fairly boring explanation, but I do quite enjoy ingenuity like that. It's like, well, we could spend however many thousand on effects, or we could just go and buy this tape for $15.
That's the way they do it now. They just run it through After Effects. I'm sure that's not what they're using in big studios. Maybe it is. And
then, MS Paint.
And you know, we'll just track these little glowing orange dots on the edge of the mesh fence there where it's been cut away. But no, it was just like a little bit of tape.
I like that.
Super cheap effect.
To fast forward through the film a little bit, and this doesn't have to be a long discussion, I just wanted to celebrate the return of something that used to pop up in our podcast all the time.
I know what's coming.
It's Arnold in a mall.
Yeah.
It's about time. He was always in malls in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And he's in another one here. And he just made my heart very happy.
Yeah, it is great. And it was really nice to see. And I could see how delighted you were when it happened as well.
I'm a simple man.
One thing Cameron is really good at in this film is mapping out the geography of a scene and everything that's going in.
Mm.
The first time I felt like I really noticed it was where John is escaping from the mall and is going down the sort of the concrete flooding channels in LA. The sort of concrete.
Is it the East River? I think it's called.
Is that what it's called? Right.
I lied.
So we're sort of driving down there, and the way that it's edited together, where it shows John goes past a ruined car, for example, looks over his shoulder, the truck hits that car. And it just maintains the pace of it and everything. When John goes past something, it's like there's no... That would be such a point where there could be like a continuity error. Everything is like bang, 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 detail, 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 makes sense. The speed, the pacing, it all works absolutely perfectly. But also, and I don't know if you picked up on this, is fast forwarding right towards the end of the film, where you've got the final fights, the final sort of fist fights, for want of a better phrase, between the T-1000 and the T-800. And you've got Arnold getting absolutely battered, he's getting his head smashed in, he gets his eye servo exposed, all those kind of things. And then he gets the pull through, which sort of kills him, and then he comes back afterwards. I don't know if you noticed, but right where that happens in the background, you can see the chain, the conveyor belt, that when he recovers and then he reaches down and he gets the grenade launcher, we then later see him coming out the top of that.
He's got a good eye for setting things up.
It's meticulous. Like, how many times have I like seen this film where I've never even noticed, like really focusing that, oh yeah, well, of course, that probably watched this so many times where it, like, it just comes out of fucking nowhere, doesn't it? He's like crawled his way around somehow. But no, it's right there.
The thing is, it's not even set up so you're supposed to notice it. It's just, to some level, it's like subconscious. You're following stuff because he's thought about the geography. You're kind of just going... Yeah, it makes sense in your head. It's like you're following it.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh my God, you know how all those kind of pointing out like cinema sins, like pointing out, oh, this is wrong, this is wrong, this wouldn't happen, this is in the wrong place. I would love if they tried it on T2. I'm sure they have tried it on T2 and found multiple things that aren't actually problems. But it's almost like he was building it to be critic-proof in that regard.
Based on what I've seen from it, I wouldn't be surprised if there's blueprints that he's designed himself of an entire steel mill.
Well,
but it's even little things like towards the end when they're trying to escape from the newly reformed and now malfunctioning T-1000, which maybe we can talk about in a minute as well. They're trying to escape and they come right up to where the lake of sort of molten metal is, and they go, no, go back, it's too hot. That's like a Chekhov's gun moment where they're saying, this thing is here and it's hot. So cameras introduced that as a filmmaker because it's like, you don't think about it then, but of course when it comes back in later, it's not like a cheat, it's not like a, well, where did they pull this fucking lake of molten metal from? It's been there.
Yeah. If you're talking in terms of terminology, it's like a Chekhov's gun like that is better than a Deus Ex Machina.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
I just use two phrases and I feel quite intelligent. Deus Ex Machina? You don't know it? It's just like when something just saves the day out of nowhere because it's a plot contrivance.
Yeah, God is in the machine, right? Is that the Latin of it? Yeah. So it's just like magic.
Yeah. Speaking of the T-800,
mm-hmm.
he calls himself Cyberdyne Systems Model 101.
Yeah.
So is he 101 and T-800?
Yes.
How does that work?
I don't know. Because here's the thing, right? Cyberdyne Systems suggests that it was Cyberdyne that designed it, not Skynet. Why is it not Skynet Systems Model 101? Why is it Cyberdyne Systems 101? It's just that his design perhaps existed prior to a Skynet.
Yeah. So basically what they're saying is they would have designed and manufactured all the T-800s in the next 2 years before Judgment Day.
Which, and we're definitely getting ahead of ourselves here, but if we fast forward then to Terminator 3 and some of the deleted content there. I'm Chief Master Sergeant William Candy. But you've got scenes like that where they are showing the making and design of the T-800. Mm. Maybe that's it, but they don't really address it in this film. But it doesn't make sense. Yeah, he is both a Model 101, but then he is a T-800. And I don't know what the difference is between the two.
No, me neither. It's like trying to buy a PC. You'd be like, oh, I don't know what any of this means.
The only thing I can say in regards to the T-800 is there's a brief line in the first film where Kyle Reese says the 600 series had rubber skin. We spotted them easy. So there's a reference to T-600s in that point.
Yeah.
But yeah, why he sort of refers to himself as a model, a Cyberdyne Systems Model 101, I don't know. This is incredibly geeky conversation. I'm loving it.
Yeah, I'm probably going to cut all of that, to be quite honest.
So I just want to talk about when we first meet the T-1000 in this one, because when we're first introduced to him, the idea is that we're not supposed to know that he's the Terminator. Mm-hmm. He attacks the cop, but we don't know at that point that in reality he's probably stabbed him. Now, I remember reading or seeing something that when Cameron was writing this film, the idea was we would not know at all. But when it came to the actual marketing of the film, they just made it clear that, you know, in the trailers spoil everything. It was out there straight away. So everybody knew into it that Arnold's the good guy. As it happens, after watching this, I was watching some... Do you ever watch those like React videos on YouTube or anything?
I was going to say exactly the same thing. I watched a woman watching this and she was fooled.
Yeah, absolutely. It was... maybe it's the same one, but it was two young women that I watched watching it. And they knew nothing about it. They'd seen the first one. They knew nothing about the build-up. So they thought that Arnold was going to be the bad guy. And they were like, who's this guy then? Is he the saviour? And it really isn't until like interaction... Mm-hmm. In the hallway, the initial fight, sponsored by Pepsi, by the way, where there's a vending machine for Pepsi and the janitor who gets shot and killed is also holding a Pepsi. I do wonder if that's one of those things where did Pepsi pay for the sponsorship of this one, or is this one of those scenes where Coca-Cola paid for the sponsorship for Pepsi to be in it?
Coca-Cola did a stop on my mum, we'll shoot on him.
Yeah, exactly. They've done it. So while I was watching this reaction video with these two women, I was like, how cool would that be? To actually experience it how it was intended to be experienced, with like not knowing and having that moment of surprise.
We're at that point now where there's a whole generations gap now where it's not assumed that everyone's seen this film anymore. Mm. So there'll be people in their 20s that'll have no idea. They probably would watch the first Terminator first because, you know, completionism is a thing. Mm. I think they would probably mostly be fooled now because it's a lot easier to avoid the marketing and there's no memes about it anymore.
No, absolutely not. There's nobody coming up to you after school or college or anything going, I tell you what, you would absolutely love Sixth Sense, but don't let anybody spoil it for you. Like, why would they spoil it? You know that he's already dead. Spoilers.
That sounds like something that happened to you.
Yeah, that one and Fight Club.
Yeah.
I don't watch a lot of the reaction videos, but I watch some of them and I've seen a couple of RoboCop ones because it's like nostalgia of like, yeah, that's kind of what it was like to watch it for the first time and you kind of get that feeling of like, yeah, it was fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Did you notice, I think it was in the film, I've not watched it again, it might have been, unless it was in your
unless
background.
Unless you dreamt it.
One thing that I feel like I've never noticed before is when the first time that the T-1000 tries to find John Connor at Todd and Janelle's house, mm-hmm. and he's like, you know, have you got a picture of John? You can hear a dog barking in the background.
Yeah, Max / Wolfie.
Yeah, now I've never noticed that before when I've been watching this film. Like later, when the T-1000 goes out to... And by the way, that's an addition, in the special edition as well. I don't, if I recall correctly, in the proper one, you don't have that. Where he goes
I was wondering that. That's a scene I don't think needs to be there because it's just gratuitous dog death.
Yeah, because the idea is it's the T-1000 going out, he's taking the collar off it, he sees the collar says Max, and he's like, oh, you got me.
Oh, of course, yeah. I never even put that together.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be in there because the T-1000 would just like, either would assume that he knows he got the dog's name wrong because... it ended there and then. Or he just wouldn't care. It's just that's happened.
Right.
Interesting bit of trivia about that dog. That is the same dog from the end of Terminator 1. And it's James Cameron's actual dog.
Huh. Did she have a dog in the Jeep?
Yeah, she had an Alsatian in the seat beside her. And actually, when you look at the photograph, which gets taken at the end of Terminator 1, which John then has in his pocket as the photograph of her, that has the Alsatian in the background. And it's the same one.
Is it meant to be the exact same dog then?
That I don't know, but why not?
Well, because it's 10 years later, maybe.
but it's the same dog. It's the real same dog. So even like in the canon of the film, it could be the same dog, because even Todd, he says before he's dispatched, "I thought you were going to tell that kid to get rid of that fucking mutt," suggesting that it is John's dog.
It probably is then. Well, that's bummed me out a little bit.
Yeah.
At least Todd gets killed.
Yeah, by that.
Tad.
By that sometimes Irish, sometimes Latina actress. She can play anything you want.
Was it Jeanette Goldstein?
I can't remember her name, but yeah.
Yeah, one of my notes is, what, Vasquez isn't Latina? Yeah, I would never have guessed. It took until like Google came along for me to figure out that that was the same person.
Yeah, I think I'd see the meme. These three characters are all the same actress. Like,
oh, who's the third?
She's in Titanic as the Irish mum.
I've not seen it.
Have you not?
We should probably talk about Arnold himself.
Why?
I think he does a really good job in this, because he's got to act stiff the entire way through, but he's got to act as a character who evolves from being non-human to human. Are you laughing at the fact I said stiff?
Sorry. I know I shouldn't.
Wow. But there's like a moment when they're fighting in the mall, and it's the moment you mentioned earlier when he gets thrown. Oh, no, it's not through a window, is it? It's through a wall. Yeah. Oh, no, he does get thrown through a window.
He goes through a wall and a window, yeah.
And when he lands, he kind of just lands prone. Mm-hmm. There's no secondary motion. There's no kind of reaction or anything. He just lays on the ground, no facial expression, and just gets back up.
Same as he does in the first one.
Yeah, but like it's so controlled in this. It's like really well disciplined in the way he does it. And his mannerisms and stuff and his vocal patterns. And then like as he goes on, he starts putting more humanity into his performance and more facial expressions and more human movement and stuff. It's not my favourite of his films, but I think it might be my favourite performance he's done.
I think we've said on a few of these episodes talking about these films is he's as good as the material that you give him. And he clearly got given good material. I might still have it somewhere in storage, but I had the Terminator 2 Judgment Day screenplay where it was like a really nice glossy thing. It was like the original screenplay. It had some of the storyboards in there as well, some of the illustrations that James Cameron did. It's a really nice piece of work, and it's amazing how close to the original screenplay the actual final film is. Mm-hmm. And I guess with an effects film, it's beneficial to have it like that, especially back then where it wasn't.
Well, especially when the writer is also the director.
Well, co-writer.
Oh, yeah. What was he? William?
Wisher. Yeah, William Wisher. By the way, going back to that scene where Arnold is thrown through the window in the mall, when he's getting up, there's a guy in the background taking photographs of him.
That's William Wisher?
That's Bill Wisher. And that's like Chekhov's camera, because then later, when the police go to visit Sarah in the hospital and they're showing her the photographs from the CCTV in the police station, and then these were taken in a mall in Reseda today, that's the photographs being taken by Bill Wisher after when
that's
he was through
really
the
cool.
background. Bill Wisher also is in Terminator 1 as well, just as Sarah and Reese are escaping from the nightclub and the Terminator chases them, gets his hair burnt off, and he's got all that smoke coming off him, which it turns out was acid. Real acid. The cop pulls over and the Terminator goes up to him, like squashes him in the car door. Uh-huh. Bill Wisher.
Oh, I was hoping you were going to say it was the guy in Tech Noir wearing the Jetsons t-shirt.
Unfortunately not.
Did he write the first one then as well?
I don't know.
Just happened to be on set and they went, do you want to write the second one?
Possibly. Yeah, but yeah, he co-wrote T2, Judgment Day.
Cool. Can we talk about the asylum? Or the institution that Sarah's in.
Yes.
There's a whole bunch of stuff going on in there. For one thing, ultra weird, pervy orderly.
Yep.
The guy who looks like a cross between Patton Oswalt and Cary Elwes, licking Sarah Connor's face while she's strapped down. It's a James Cameron film, so the moment that happens, you go, oh, he's 100% going to get killed in a second.
Yeah.
It's so satisfying the way she does it. Uses it. Is it like a police baton or a security guard baton?
No, she takes a nightstick baton off him. She hits him with a broken-off mop stick.
That's true, yeah. Linda Hamilton got ripped.
Yep.
You would not mess with her. Not only because she's ripped, but also because she's terrifying. But there's so many things going on in that hospital. For one thing, there's the doctor from the first film.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Silverman.
There's a moment in... This is of all the things to pick out. There's a moment where he's yawning while he's talking. Because his whole thing is that he's just like so casual about not giving a shit about her well-being or whatever. He says to increase the medication to someone. And he ends up sounding exactly like Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs. Because yawning just goes, increase the medication.
Do you reckon he's somewhere in the basement of the hospital? There's a well.
The medication's just lotion.
Talking about the hospital and actually Sarah's stay there, I just wonder how long, in terms of the number of days, hours, weeks, whatever, how long would you say the timeline is of this film?
What, from the Terminator's arrival to the smelting pool thing?
Yeah.
I don't think more than about 3 days.
Yeah. I've always understood it to be he arrives at night, then there's a day, and then there's a night, and that's it.
Yeah, because it doesn't any longer, and the sense of urgency of being chased seems, you know, it's like if it turns out there's a whole thing of like 2 weeks where the T-1000's just sat in a cafe wondering what's going on.
Just like stirring his tea with his finger in the shape of a spoon. The reason I'm asking about the what you think the timeline is because in the space of this film, in the space of this like night, day, night, or even like just the first half of the film, what we see is we're introduced to Sarah where she's upended her bed and she's doing pull-ups, chin-ups on the bed. And Dr. Silverman is like, you know, taking around some student doctors, maybe something like that, or some visiting doctors, whatever. And he says to her, he's like, hi, Sarah, how are you doing? And she says, hi, Dr. Silverman, how's the knee? And he says to them, oh, she stabbed me in my kneecap with a pen a few weeks ago. Okay. Mm-hmm. So clearly she's just destroyed a cell or she's messed up a cell and then she's recently stabbed him in the knee. Then later we see where she's like reviewing the video from her last parole hearing or whatever it is, her last like health review, whatever, where she's obviously going nuts and everything like that. And then she's very calm and she's saying, I've had something, it helps to have something to look forward to. And he says, you have shown improvement over the last 6 months. And I'm like, you just said, not an hour ago, that she stabbed you in the kneecap with your pen. So how is that? Is that improvement? What was she doing before that?
That's a good point. I feel like that is a CinemaSins ding.
Yep, absolutely. As soon as it happened, I was like, what? Really? Okay, if you say so.
That's not the kind of thing I would have noticed, but that's a really good point.
Yeah.
To be fair, that guy's just a complete douche. He probably made the stuff up about the pen. In the words of Jack Torrance, I think he did it to himself.
I like him as a character. He's a good actor. Even when he gets introduced in the first film, when he gets brought into the police station. And by the way, he missed that massacre by 2 minutes. I don't remember the first film. He nearly bumps into the Terminator as he's on his way out. He only misses him because his beeper goes off. He turns around. The Terminator walks in and then Silverman walks out. He doesn't acknowledge it in Terminator 2, but this isn't the first time he's heard the story. The first time he heard the story was from Kyle Reese. He told the entire story. And Silverman's got a point where they're watching the video recording and he's talking to the cops and whatever, and he pauses it and he goes, I could make a career out of this guy. And it makes you think that, is that what he's now doing with Sarah? He's trying to make a career out of her. But he's now gone from being a police psychologist or whatever to now he's running his own facility.
That's entirely possible. He's an ambitious jerk kind of character.
But he never acknowledges at all that he met her before when she appeared normal, didn't believe any of it.
No.
He was treating her for trauma. He never acknowledges at all that she has transformed over time from this person who 10 years ago didn't believe this thing but has now almost like adopted the hallucination, the illusion.
Maybe he's... I don't know, I was going to say maybe he'd forgotten about Kyle Reese in the 10 years, but like that's his name would have come up quite a lot. Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
Well made.
I've got a note here. Again, this is an added scene, or rather it's a scene that was not taken out, or was taken out in the final cut, where John is attempting to teach the Terminator how to smile.
Oh, yeah.
And you get this really awkward, sort of tight-lipped thing from the Terminator. And he manages to, he finds his smile later, doesn't he, which is kind of like a wry sort of cocking of the corner of his mouth.
Yeah, the trailer shot.
Yeah, absolutely. He does it a couple of times. He does it one with a minigun, And then he does it again when he's going to go and deal with the police. And he's like, hey, you swore. And he's like, trust me.
Mm-hmm.
But just after that, I've got a note where I've literally written, I've just been watching it again. I think I had one of those gaps of sort of like 10, 15 minutes where I wasn't paying attention like to making notes. I was just watching the fucking film.
I don't think that's a problem. No. You remember stuff. That's the good thing. Do you notice that the T-1000 is missing from the film for at least 30 minutes?
They get a good head start on him at one point. It's after they escape from the hospital, right?
Yeah, from the moment they get away from him in the hospital when he's like rolling around on the ground with his Homer Simpson with golf clubs moment.
Yeah.
He's not a big part of the plot for quite a long time. It's almost like the T-1000 as a threat is kind of secondary to just the idea of the future being inevitable kind of thing. Mm. He's not like so much a threat as he is the embodiment of James Cameron's writing.
He's like a pacing device. He's the only reason why they've got, in our timeline, 2.5 hours to do this.
Yeah.
In the film's timeline, I guess like 2 days to do all this. Because otherwise, again, if we're to assume that this is, you know, set in sort of 95, then they've got 2 years to intervene and stop Judgment Day. So the only reason they've not got 2 years and there is a real sort of time pressure is because of the T-1000. He's very much the dog that's nipping at their heels.
And he actually has a lower kill count by quite a long way than the T-800 in the first film. Partly that's why this doesn't feel as much like the end of the R-rated film that the first one is. I think he kills less than 10 people.
And also the kills are clean.
Yeah. He also, have you noticed that every time he kills someone with his, like, finger blade or whatever, he always kind of, like, looks at them and, like, studies them and cocks his head. Is that a Michael Myers reference?
It's got that kind of vibe, yeah, like he is sort of studying him. So whether it's a deliberate reference or not, I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's either, Michael Myers or a dog, you know, cocking his head because he's curious.
Yeah, I think he's trying to get across that he's sort of like curious learning, but it's like a really inhuman thing to do.
It's the kind of the pulling the wings off a fly cruelty.
Yeah.
I'm doing this, but I feel nothing. I'm just wondering why everyone cares so much.
Here's a question for you. Seeing as we're sort of talking about the attack on Cyberdyne, which is, you know, bringing us towards the end of the film, or certainly into the last sort of 20 minutes or so. And again, you've got the hero shot as the Terminator is walking away saying, trust me. He goes to the window, kicks the desk out, minigun, open fire. Obviously, he's not trying to hit anybody. He destroys the cars, shoots at the people's feet, all that kind of stuff. And at the end of it, he's scanning the area, and his read says, human casualties, 0.0. What's the fucking 0.0? Like, what would the 0.0 be? Like, oh, well, he lost a leg. There was a wild ricochet that nobody could have foreseen there, blew his teeth out.
Casualties are separate from injuries, right? So it would mean that someone had part of a death. A little death.
That's something different. That's a French thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. There's like all the policemen survived, but one of them had le petit mort.
One of them was just kind of like, oh, this is my kink. Oh. He's shooting at me.
Oh my god. I think we've cracked it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, the LAPD physio is going to be overrun.
Unbelievably so.
Because no one dies, but everybody gets injured.
Yeah, the entire SWAT team collecting the pension next week.
Tell you what else looks great. That shot when he rips the skin off his arm to show the Terminator arm.
De-sleeving.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, when somebody gets the flesh ripped off the hand, it's called de-sleeving.
That's disgusting. Oh my god. Oh, to me, of all the effects, all the disgusting effects that are in this film, that's one of the ones that makes me wince, but it looks so good.
But it's great, and it's the camera angle, because they're on a bit of a deadline, you know, in terms of what they need to do. They need to convince this guy as quickly as possible that all this stuff is true. And it's curious that John Connor gave the Terminator the knife and then the Terminator knew exactly what to do. Maybe they talked about it on the car ride on the way over, I'm not too sure. But then it's the shot from behind the metal arm where this is another Chekhov's moment, because you have earlier when we first meet Dyson in the lab and he goes to check out the chip, the metal arm is in there as well.
Yeah.
And in that scene, we see the camera behind the arm looking at Dyson, and Dyson's just like staring at it like, what the fuck is this thing? And then it fast forwards to this point where it's the same shot and I'm like, beautiful. That's the point where you know he realises, I know exactly what this fucking thing is, even though I've got no idea what this thing is.
It ties together so well.
The level of attention to detail in this film is meticulous. Yeah. Over the years, you know, you hear the stories about what James Cameron is like as a filmmaker and what a fucking nightmare he is to work with in many ways. But proof is in the pudding, do you know what I mean? There's no excuse for being a dickhead, really. But
no, it's horrible in the moment, but sometimes the result is timeless.
He's just cursed with vision. If he's not getting his vision, then he's not a happy guy.
That's true.
Did you notice that after the T-1000 had been frozen, shattered, remelted, and then reformed again, that afterwards he was glitching?
Yeah.
There was a point where he is sort of walking around and it's like the texture map or whatever was rippling on his face. And there's even a point, there's a point where he's walking and his feet are melting and meshing into the diamond plate.
I love that.
It looked great. And
yeah,
then
he turned into Nick Nolte from Hulk.
Yeah, because he puts his hand on the rail and he sticks to it.
Yeah.
Not in the theatrical cut.
Is it not?
Another thing that is not shown at all.
Wow. It's apparently like an unwritten rule of cinema that if you don't see a body, it means that Robert Patrick's going to return in the form of a tech demo. I mean, it is just showing off, right?
It's just a cool visual that doesn't necessarily add anything apart from going, Hulk's fucking cool.
Apropos of nothing, you know when Janelle is on the phone talking about Wolfie and whatnot, you know, something's wrong, she's never this nice.
Yeah.
She's chopping vegetables for dinner.
Yeah.
But it's the T-1000. why is the T-1000 making dinner?
It's committed to the bit.
It's the patriarchy. It's just like, oh, this is my role.
What if John Connor had, like, not come back for the weekend? Like, would he have stayed there as Janelle, you know, fulfilling all the roles of a wife?
Yeah. Cocking his head as he's having sex with Todd.
Cocking his head as his head in his cock.
I understand that this is an experience that people enjoy. I am curious to learn.
They do have detailed files on the human anatomy, so...
That's true. Do you reckon there's a version of this film from the T-1000's perspective where he just wants his job to be over so he can just go out and experience life? Just live, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I remember you saying that you haven't watched this for probably the longest time since you first saw it, right? Because you were saving it for the podcast.
Absolutely. I've been deliberately not watching this. I've been deliberately not watching any Schwarzenegger films for the entire time we've been making this podcast until we've watched
it. Really? Oh, yeah. I've been watching them all the time.
Just, you're not committed.
That's a lie. I've only watched one.
I used to watch this at least once a year, probably more. And I think when we were watching it last week, I mentioned that this used to be on TV like all the time. And I'd always like drop in whatever point it was on, I'd drop in and watch it for however long I could. So I used to watch it at least once a year, maybe more. And then when we started recording this podcast, which was over 2 years ago, almost 2.5 years ago now, including, you know, breaks and stuff that we've been away for. Yeah, so I've not watched this film. I can definitely confirm for definite, I've not watched this film at all for 2.5 years before we watched it last week.
Man, thank you for your service.
Thank you. You know, I wasn't going to ask you to say it, but I'm glad that you did.
No, I appreciate it, because it's if it's one of those films where, like, you can watch it any time, then that's quite a sacrifice, you know? It's like me not watching White Men Can't Jump for 2 years.
But, you know, I'm not going to spoil for what we're probably going to talk about in just a few minutes or so, but, you know, it was worth the wait. You know, cool. I was pleasantly surprised by how much, like, my memorization of the script came flooding back, and I knew all the lines and the intonations and the pacing, and yeah.
Yeah, this is definitely more, like, feels more owned by you, this film, than it does me.
Thank you, I think. But yeah, I feel like I've said everything that I had to say, probably said more than I needed to say. And, you know, while I could go on talking about this film for hours more, potentially, I think it's maybe worth drawing the episode to a close.
Yeah, let's get out of here.
So all we have to do now, really, is to rate this thing. And for first-time listeners, when we do rate these films, we do it on a binary rating system.
With nuance.
Where we say, if we think that you should watch this film, we will say, do it now. And if we think that you should not watch this film, we will say, put the cookie down. So, Jamie, for 1991's Terminator 2 Judgment Day, is it do it now or put the cookie down?
Well, it's doing now, isn't it? I don't want to be that much of a contrarian. I'm definitely not as big a fan of this as most people seem to be. I think it's very well made. I think it's very shiny and glossy, and like we say, it all ties together very well. The action's well directed, the choreography and the acting and whatever. It's very good quality. It just doesn't connect with me on the level that it seems to with most other people. Like you, I prefer the first one. I think I just like my boobies kind of quick and dirty and see the joins. And this is a little... I hesitate to say it's unnecessary. It feels like unfinished business from Cameron. It's almost like the way that George Lucas redid the Star Wars films because you could now achieve his vision. I feel like that was what Cameron was doing, but Cameron's a lot better at it, so it was probably more worthwhile having that attempt. But that sounds like I'm being negative about it. I actually do think it's a very good film. Like I say, it's probably Arnold's best performance. It was like a role that was made for him, even though it was made for Lance Henriksen. Yeah, do it now. Sir, same question.
Absolutely do it now. For definite. And I hear everything you're saying and I get it. This is just one of these films where I think if you'd have asked me 20 years ago as a younger man to choose between this and Terminator, I probably would have said this. You know, This is more of a crowd pleaser, I would perhaps say for this one. Out of the two films, Terminator 1, Terminator 2, this is the crowd pleaser. But I think as the years have gone on, I've sort of really recognised that, you know, we've touched on it already, that this is almost a beat for beat, not exactly a remake, but almost like a reimagining of the first film. And like you say, I agree with what you're saying. It, you know, there is an element of this feeling like unfinished business from James Cameron. He wanted to do the liquid metal Terminator in the first one, couldn't do it. So now he's got the technologies to do it. So it's absolutely all those things. But this is definitely just one of these films where I think it does something that not a lot of films are very successful at doing, where it's a really sort of, it's a high concept film. It's a crowd pleaser that is just smart enough to not make you feel like an idiot for watching it, but not so smart that it makes you feel like an idiot while you're watching it.
That's a good point.
It walks this really delicate tightrope. Even the way it describes some of the science and stuff in it, it's like, it says just enough for you to be like, yeah, I kind of get that. Don't need to know anymore because we're on to the next car chase. It holds your hand, but it's really pulling you through the entire film in like and it just never stops. The pacing is perfect. The action is great. It's a 2.5-hour film if you watch the full version like we did, but there's never a jingle all the way moment where you're sort of 40 minutes in going, this must be nearly finished. If you've never seen it, go and watch it now. I can't imagine there's many people who don't like this film. So yeah, absolutely. Do it now, dickwad. Right, so that is the film rated. Now we need to find out what we're going to be watching and talking about next time. What is it we need to do, Jamie?
Spin the wheel of pain.
Yeah. So the film that we are going to be watching and talking about next time is Red Sonja.
Okay, yeah, I'm good with that. I feel like we needed something a bit different because we've had quite a few sort of urban environments set in America kind of things for a while now. So yeah, why not?
Yeah, I've not seen this film for a very, 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 very long time, so...
It'll be good as new.
God, yeah, good as new, however good that was at the time.
I was not expecting it to be very good.
Do you know what? Let's see.
I'm sure it'll be fine. It's not Conan, though.
Conan was fucking great.
No, I mean, like, it's not Conan in it.
Oh, no. I mean, he's basically Conan as far as I recall, but no.
Okay.
So that brings us to the end of another episode. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on the socials on Instagram at PodActionHero.
And we're also at PodActionHero on Letterboxd. And if you go into your podcast player of choice, give us a rating, a high one please, and give us a review in the ones that will let you do that, then I won't need your clothes, your boots, or your motorcycle.
I've been Gavin.
I've been Jamie.
And we will speak to you again next time.